You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the late 1960s and early 70s, Paramount Studios produced movies like Rosemary's Baby, The Godfather, Chinatown, and Catch 22. But despite those successes, in his latest book, Peter Bard, a former Paramount vice president, describes the studio as, quote, a black hole of conflict and corruption. Infamous Players, a tale of movies, the mob, and sex, is published by Weinstein Books, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Mr. Bard back to our show. Hello.
Hello.
Any irony in the fact that a studio is publishing a book about another studio?
Not really, because Harvey Weinstein has been a very faithful publisher, and his book company has three books on the bestseller list now. So there is that sector of his life that he supports assiduously.
Was it just Paramount, or was much of Hollywood corrupt in the 60s and 70s?
I'd not say corrupt is the word. I would say disorganized and kind of... Do you remember the key element about Hollywood in the 60s and 70s was that it had run out of capital? The studios were basically broke, so there was a wonderful opportunity for someone to come along, including the mob, and buy a little piece of the action.
Well, the mob had always been there through the unions, but and now they were taking over the studios as well?
In the early days of Hollywood, the unions were mob-controlled. They were not taking over the studios, but there were several forces at work. To begin with, remember Deep Throat was the biggest hit of the 70s, and Deep Throat, the porn movie, was owned and distributed by the mob. And indeed, they knew more about marketing, I think, than the regular studios did. But on the other side, you did have figures like Sidney Korshak, who became important players on the studio scene. And remember, Korshak was an attorney whose first client was Al Capone.
And then later, one of his clients was Charles Bludorn, the head of Gulf and Western?
Well, Korshak was close to Bludorn, who was the first great conglomerator. And also he was very close to Lou Wasserman, who then ran Universal Pictures and had previously really owned the talent agency business. So now, he was well connected.
Now, you mentioned Bludorn as a conglomerator. He took Gulf and Western from being a metal bumper stamping company to owning communications properties like Paramount Pictures, Stax Records, Sega, Simon & Schuster. They also own Madison Square Garden and, by extension, the New York Rangers and the New York Knicks. Kaiser Roth, a clothing company that owned the Miss Universe pageant, the Bohack supermarket chain here in New York, a sugar company, Simmons Bedding Company.
But the frustration,
there's no connection here.
The frustration that he had was he wanted to own the Dominican Republic, and he wanted to have an important influence on Cuba. Now, in the Dominican Republic, he had a vast estate there and was very influential in several regimes in the Dominican Republic.
That's the South Puerto Rico Sugar Company.
That's right.
That was not from Puerto Rico, but from the Dominican Republic.
But Bludorn's, one of his great aims in life was to convert Fidel Castro, then a young man, to become a capitalist. And he spent a good deal of time with Fidel trying to interest him in the fact that if he joined Bludorn in controlling the sugar business, that Fidel could be a wealthy man as well as a powerful man, and Bludorn could share his power. Fidel turned on him, though, and he decided that Charlie Bludorn was not a political ally he could trust.
Well, how did Charlie Bludorn even get into all of this? How did he take over Gulf and Western?
Well, he started really as a trader. He was a brilliant commodities trader. He was an immigrant from somewhere in Eastern Europe. No one ever knew for sure. He was a brilliant man, but he loved movies. He had this terrible problem that I think you would understand and share. He thought movies were the most wonderful avocation and loved particularly musicals. For example, his great dream was to make a picture with Julie Andrews. He made Paint Your Wagon. That was one of the first pictures he fostered. So he made big, really bad musicals.
Well, the feeling was when Paint Your Wagon came out that the age of the musicals had already passed.
That's right.
But not for Charles Bludorn.
And not for Dick Zanuck either, across town, because The young president of 20th Century Fox, remember, made pictures like Dr. Doolittle and Star. He felt, too, that the musical would come of age again.
Now, Gulf and Western acquired Paramount in 1966. Were there problems at the studio before?
The only problem was we had no money.
You say that you were not there yet.
No, I was there. I came there in 67 with my good friend Bob Evans. But basically, Paramount had run out of gas. I mean, when I got there, we were still making a few Elvis Presley movies. And Charlie Bluton had just bought it, so they were making pictures like Paint Your Wagon. But the point is that the whole taste of the nation had changed radically. And suddenly, the people who owned the studios, like Bluton, were trying to figure out why. Why would audiences go to see Easy Rider or Midnight Cowboy? What was happening?
You were a journalist at the time. You'd worked here and then moved to Los Angeles, where at the Los Angeles Times.
I worked for the New York Times, and I was their West Coast guy. Mm. And it was a very exciting time because the Watts riots happened in that era. And the politics of California are always fascinating.
Well, were you aware of what was happening at the studios?
Yeah, I was aware of it. But you know something? It didn't matter that much to me. I really wanted to be a newsman. This was a great job for me. But Bob Evans was a personal friend of mine. And when he got offered this job to run a movie studio, we had a drink one night, and he said, you know, I have no credentials for this position whatsoever. And he said, I'd like you to come with me. I said, why? He said, because you don't have any credentials either, because you can't make me look bad. So I said, yeah, what's the downside?
Well, why was Bluton interested in Evans? Since he didn't have any track record.
Well, Bob was a very glamorous figure, number one. He was very handsome and very dynamic person. And he had begun to make quite an impact as a producer. He owned the rights to several intriguing properties, like there was a hot book at the time called The Detective. And Bob was someone who in Charlie Bluton's eyes, represented a certain Hollywood glamour. Remember, he had been an actor of some success, Evans had.
But now there's been a documentary about his complicated life. Was it as complicated at that time, or did all of the problems arise after he wound up in a position of power in a studio?
Well, Bob Evans' life always was very complicated. He did have a taste for and a talent for women. But as things went along, as Paramount became incredibly successful because of Love Story and The Godfather and other movies, Bob had a degree of problems handling success. Don't we all?
Well, there were parties. There was alcohol. There were drugs. This was a time when there was a lot of cocaine in the movie business, wasn't there?
There was a great deal of cocaine. It was a party drug, really. It was sort of a matter-of-fact issue. But, you know, you'd be interested in this. In those days, when I would line up a director for a movie, what you'd do, which you don't do today anymore, was you'd really effectively Google someone's personal life to see what would they have any problem with the drug at that moment? Was their personal life in shape? I mean, so many people of great talent were destroying themselves with drugs, that would be an important part of the issue as to whether to hire them to direct or not.
What were your duties starting off at the studio?
Well, I thought my duties would be to help line up some literary properties. But at the third meeting of the staff, I expressed fondness for a script. And the head of business affairs looked at me and said, so you like the script? So? So I said, well, yeah, it's a good script. So he said, so? I said, what do you mean, so? So he said, what do you want to pay for it? You're going to pay $100,000, $500,000? I mean, it's your decision, man. There's no committee on here. If you like something, you buy it. And that kind of distorted my life because for the rest of my life, even today, when I read something, I think, what is it going to cost me?
Well, were there any parameters there? A script comes in. I would immediately offer the writer as little as I could. And then we would negotiate from there.
You know, there were remarkably little controls in that day because the studios were absolutely desperate, were bent on recovery. And there was no support mechanism at Paramount. Evans and I really did what we wanted in terms of assembling a new slate of pictures. That's why the job was so exciting.
Peter Bard is my guest. His latest book, Infamous Players, Tale of Movies, The Mob, and Sex, which is published by Weinstein Books. How involved was Gulf and Western in the day-to-day operations of Paramount?
Well, by and large, the corporate players withdrew from running the studio until The Godfather came along. And now, Bob and I had bought the rights to The Godfather and actually developed the book. We subsidized the book because poor Mario Puzo had run out of money. But what happened was that after we hired Francis Coppola and agreed on Al Pacino and Marlon Brando, the book was published and became this huge international bestseller. And suddenly, Charlie Bluto and all the corporate offices, they had their own idea of how this picture should be put together. Francis Coppola was not a candidate because he just directed Finian's Rainbow and was a young guy. They hated Pacino. They hated Brando. And The Godfather was really thrown into chaos for many, many months.
And wasn't Pacino already scheduled to be in another film at MGM?
Yes, he's going to do that gang that couldn't shoot straight. And by the time that basically the corporate
Jimmy
guys...
Jimmy Breslin...
I don't know if it was
Breslin. Yeah.
Yeah,
And then that was a movie version.
And De Niro ended up with the role, so he ended up okay, too.
And then De Niro winds up in the second Godfather film.
That's right, yeah. So these were the players.
Was there resistance to making the film at the start until the book became a bestseller?
There wasn't, because it was our plan to make it for $7 million and to do it as a relatively inexpensive picture. And so no one paid attention. But then, as I say, when the spotlight went on, then everyone decided that the greatest stars in the world and the most important directors, this should become an important and expensive movie. That would have been its death knell.
No, you did make some enemies. Frank Sinatra didn't like you.
Yeah.
He didn't like Robert Evans, and he didn't like The Godfather.
Yeah, and honestly, I didn't like Frank Sinatra too much either. He was kind of a tough boss. But that antagonism stemmed from the fact that Mia Farrow, then his wife, was starring in Rosemary's Baby, and he didn't feel that she was being treated respectfully.
Well, the way she tells the story is the film was taking longer to make than he wanted, and he said, we have plans to go to the Bahamas, quit the film, and she said, I can't, I'm in the middle of shooting, and that ended the marriage.
Well, yeah, it was a little nastier than that, because Roman Polanski was putting it through 25, 30 takes, because he was, to a degree, breaking her down to find another Mia Farrow. He really wanted a performance. And so Sinatra sent his attorney, who's a rather hideous guy, in to see me. And he said, you know, Bart, if you'd like to preserve your health and that of your family, it would really be a good idea if you put a limit of 2 takes on Mia Farrow. So I said, why don't you see Bob Evans? I mean, that to threaten him, he's single. So they said, no, you can do it. I know you brought in Roman. You can nail him. So I got that responsibility. We didn't do it.
You write that Arthur Hiller's Love Story was the first film that you went out on a limb for. How did that script come to you?
Well, it was a script that no one wanted. And given the fact that pictures like Easy Rider were causing so much attention, I felt, stupidly perhaps, that it would be interesting to do something more retro, do a very conventional love story, rich kid, poor girl sort of story, and you know, something interesting about setting a piece at Harvard. So I was a proponent of this, and Bob Evans came aboard eagerly, and of course he became very interested in Ally McGraw, who was an actress who became a star off that picture.
In fact, they married afterward.
They did.
You say it was the ultimate date movie. Did that start the trend of date movies? There must have been date movies before.
It was beyond a date movie, because I noticed when early on I did an informal survey of the audiences when they left the theater. I found the young boys who were taking girls and they would cry together and hold hands, that all the guys were scoring after this movie. Love Story was the first true aphrodisiacal movie that I had ever observed.
And there's no way you could have anticipated that love means never having to say you're sorry would become such a quotable line.
Love meant you always got laid after seeing that movie.
Well, Not everybody. I think I saw that movie. What's the story about
I feel bad about that.
What's the story about Blue Dorn yelling at a theater manager about the film?
Well, yeah, we were in a limo going around Manhattan, and, you know, there'd been so many unsuccessful pictures that Paramount had made. Charlie Blue Dorn couldn't believe that there were lines outside the theater. So not knowing that much about the movie business, he suddenly, after we passed the third theater where the line came racing out of the car, and grabbed the theater manager and he said, "Idiot, don't just stand there, raise the prices."
He didn't understand that you didn't do that in movie theaters.
And you still don't.
Peter Bart, his latest book, Infamous Players, A Tale of Movies, the Mob, and Sex, is published by Weinstein Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Peter Bart, who started his career as a newsman with the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, and then spent 17 years as a film executive, as vice president of Paramount, senior vice president of MGM, and president of Lorimar, before he returned to journalism as editor-in-chief of Variety. He's written a number of books, which have brought him to our show, both nonfiction and fiction. And his latest is something of a film business memoir called Infamous Players, A Tale of Movies, the Mob, and Sex. It is published by Weinstein Books. Another film that you were involved with is one of those films that I often wonder, how the heck did this movie ever get made? Harold and Maude.
It's a good question. It certainly would not have been made today. This would have been anathema at any studio. I mean, if you imagine in an era where almost all of the movies are sequels or prequels, imagine a producer walking in and say, "I want to do an original picture about a love affair between an 18-year-old boy and an 80-year-old woman."
Well, I imagine it was a hard sell at the studio even then.
You know, it wasn't, because those days a very radical precept entered the mix, and that is that if a couple of studio executives really wanted to see a movie, they would arrange to get it made. I mean, I just, as a sample, I had lunch by coincidence with two different top film executives the other day in Los Angeles, the top production people at the studios. And I asked them a simple question. Are you personally looking forward to seeing any of the movies on your summer slate of films? And they looked at me gravely and said, "Absolutely not." Mm. So we were selfish. We made Harold and Maude because we were really looking forward to seeing it.
And a film like that becomes a so-called cult classic. Does that mean it continues to make money for Paramount?
It actually played a couple of theaters for about 15 years. It didn't start out very happily, but it ended up being a very profitable picture and a real cult movie.
And what about a film like Godfather, which many people cite as their favorite film of all time? Does that continue to make money? I would assume we're talking about, in this case, in DVDs and now in the new Blu-ray version.
Well, my perspective on The Godfather is skewed by this fact that when the picture was finished, the final cut was shown to the top marketing and distribution people at Paramount. And they all came up to Evans and then to myself and said, "No one's going to see this picture. It's too talky. It's too dark. It's too long. There's no action. It'll die in Europe in particular." So there was actually a reluctance to support the picture from that side of the company.
And when that happens, that means that it's harder to get advertising dollars, which
Absolutely.
Almost guarantees that a movie is going to flop.
And remember, in those days, pictures opened in just a few cities and built word of mouth. So you really did count on building the audience, whereas today you open in 5,000 theaters and spend $150 million to support a picture. So you tell the audience today what they want to see. You don't actually try to sell. But let me ask you, you're a film student. Why has The Godfather become such an iconic picture?
Well, it's a good film. I don't think it's the greatest movie ever made, but I think that enough people have said it's the greatest movie ever made. And then, you know, if you're told a certain restaurant is the best restaurant, then it becomes the best restaurant, whether it really is or not.
Well, I asked you that because I am surprised, and it happened again to me this week, that so many people do single The Godfather out as iconic, as their favorite picture of all time, and one that really influenced them in terms of many top filmmakers talk about the important influences that The Godfather had on their sense of style and performance.
Well, in what way do you see it when you see a film today?
Well, of course,
enough explosions to explain what's going on today.
By today's standards, it would be considered an art picture because today everything is about special effects and every hero, basically, the stories are basically from comic books or video games. I mean, the whole nature of filmmaking, as well as the business model, is antithetical to what existed then.
You started logging your thoughts as you worked on various projects, and you write, "Politics and movies are a disastrous mix." And you also say, "Satire doesn't work on the screen." I'm thinking about Dr. Strangelove, Network, Spinal Tap.
That's right. And even
they were successes, weren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. See, in that era, Paramount also came out with pictures like The Parallax View, The Conformist, The President's Analyst, which was a political satire.
Did that make any money?
It did not. It broke even, but it wasn't a big hit.
But Parallax View made money. It was a terrific film.
But The President's Analyst, J. Edgar Hoover, was so offended that a studio would actually make a satire about the FBI, that he beat the hell out of the CEO of Gulf and Western to not release the picture. It was very political dynamite. But the whole issue of political pictures and pictures about social issues fascinates me because they're anathema today. And, you know, once again, no studio wants to make a picture that has any political overtones, certainly that deals with Iraq or Afghanistan. Whereas those subjects were staples of filmmaking in the 60s and 70s.
Well, we've had a couple of films about Iraq, including one that won Oscar for, was it Best Picture, at least Best Director, and didn't make any money.
Yes.
So is this the fault of the studios or the fault of the audiences?
I think it's both. I think the trouble with most pictures that deal with interesting issues like The Hurt Locker is it's so hard to raise the money for them and to raise the money to sell them that basically everyone condemns the pictures before they're out. But it's also the fault of the audiences in a way. But let's defend the audience in this sense. If you live in most places in America, the multiplex isn't going to give you a chance to discover pictures. They're just going to run Pirates of the Caribbean Part 4 on all their screens. So the audiences are not being nurtured, really.
Well, there were people who we now consider major figures in film who were having problems then as well. Clint Eastwood, for example, until Sergio Leone figured out how to use him well, he was having a miserable career. Now he's not only considered one of the iconic actors, but one of the best directors of all time.
What I always loved about Clint was he was, as a young man, a totally unpretentious person. I mean, Warren Beatty and even Redford would often, as young actors, talk about their visions as filmmakers, that they were not going to simply be leading men, but they're going to have important careers as a filmmaker. Clint never talked about that. I mean, he was a very modest, somewhat introspective guy who basically would talk to you about girls, but he wouldn't talk to you about films. And what he did was he used his filmmaking experience as an actor, as with Leone, as a chance to learn filmmaking. I mean, Sergio Leone, without knowing it, taught him about composition and about performance, about camera angles, and Clint was there taking notes.
And then he came back here and worked with one of the most respected of the independent type filmmakers, a man who we just recently were talking about because of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the wonderful star Dana Winter died recently. But Clint Eastwood looks more like that kind of director than he does like a Sergio Leone director.
Yeah, but
I don't know. I'm saying that I can't remember the guy's name. He's such a wonderful director.
Yeah, I can't either. But I asked Clint, why, as he goes from one picture to the next, all of the films are so different in terms of their background and their subject matter. And he looked at me very seriously, he always talks in single sentences quickly. And he said, you know, to me, filmmaking is an experience to learn. Every movie is an education. And I don't want to repeat the same learning experience. So that's why, more than any other filmmaker, he refuses to stay with a genre. He keeps wandering. In his own modest way, he is perhaps the most intelligent of the filmmakers of that era.
And my crack staff reminds me that the director I was trying to think of was Don Siegel.
Don Siegel, who absolutely was the mentor to Clint. He always hung back in Clint Eastwood's first couple of pictures and would help him through the experience.
Now, you mentioned Robert Redford. You say he was difficult to work with.
I certainly do. And then one reason being that, though a very intelligent person, a thoughtful man, he is perhaps one of the most non-confrontive people I've ever met. I mean, he would never sit with you and say, I don't agree with you on this and this and this. He simply disappears or makes the decisions on his own. But my own style is I like people who will simply take you on and confront you, not simply vanish.
I used to be in the record business, and one of the complaints in the 80s was that everybody wanted a blockbuster, or they were not really interested in releasing a record. It had to sell a million, or else who cared? You'd just bury it. And the same thing happened in the movies business.
Well, it certainly happened today, basically.
Wasn't it the 80s, from the 80s on?
Well, in the middle of the 80s, as home video began to become prominent, and as the television market, cable television, the market for movies began to increase, a lot of people, smart people, suddenly realized the movie business is not a fringe business. It could be a tremendously profitable business. And so Michael Eisner, Jeffrey Katzenberg, these folks introduced the idea of the high concept picture, Beverly Hills Cop, Top Gun, and that basically changed the whole nature of filmmaking.
I would have thought Titanic has changed everything.
Well, even more than that, Avatar has, because Avatar has shown that there can be a marriage between technical genius, technological innovation, and really good drama.
So what led to you and Bob Evans leaving the Paramount?
Well, the that time and that cast of characters were so incendiary, there's no way that management group at Paramount could have survived. Everybody was fighting with everyone else, and even though it was clear, and I think Bob Evans has been underestimated as a filmmaker. He was a man of great taste and knowledge and dedication to film.
But you were making money, weren't you?
We were making money, but the intramural battling was too intense. And everything, frankly, just blew up. And I was kind of glad because it was a tough way to live, and I had a chance to move on to other jobs, which, frankly, I at that time enjoyed a lot more.
Other studios first.
Studios, yeah. I mean, the last picture at Lorimar that I fostered was called Being There with Peter Sellers. And again, it was an example of a picture. Hal Ashby directed that. A picture that couldn't get made today. Do you know, it was... And if you watch it today, I think you'll find it's a really enjoyable picture that still resonates because Chauncey Gardner and George W. Bush are really the same person.
Peter Sellers playing George W. Bush, you're saying?
He did without knowing it.
So then in 1989, you became the editor of the Weekly Variety and then moved on to take up the Daily Variety as well. But after 20 years, you were named Vice President Editorial Director, which was the equivalent of being kicked upstairs, was it?
Well, no, I'd been editor for 20 years and was getting of a certain time that I didn't want to manage the newspaper anymore. I mean, at 20 years was always the deal, and I had no intention of staying on. So, plus, I had a national television show to do called Show Business. It was first called on AMC called Shootout. And, you know, the television business, bear this in mind, is a hell of a lot more profitable than the journalism business. So I went at the television and had a great time.
Is that why we're seeing some of the kinds of movies that you are talking about making in the 70s on cable television these days?
Yes.
HBO, Showtime, and now we've even seen some of the others like AMC getting into the business as well.
Absolutely. You know, I am co-producing a four-part miniseries with Bob Evans at HBO. And really, cable television is really doing so many of the kinds of films that the companies should have and would have done in the 70s.
What happened to Paramount? I don't remember seeing too many Paramount films recently.
No, Paramount is thriving very successfully under Brad Gray. The company, again, has a very different business model. It distributes as many major important pictures, like the Transformers. The Transformers, this picture probably cost $300 million to make, will probably do way over $1 billion. I mean, that's another business. And Michael Bay, you should have on sometime, because he's a great character. But that business, the Transformers, has nothing to do with the business that I was lucky enough to be part of in the 70s.
So now that is the ultimate blockbuster kind of film.
Yes, it's
you spend a. Do you have to spend that kind of money? I remember Clint Eastwood once snidely commenting that the budget on some film was enough to pay for the invasion of a small country.
Well, look, the total cost of The Godfather would not have covered the craft services bill on the Transformers. You know, do you need to spend that kind of money? Let's put it this way. If you are looking for a $1 billion blockbuster, if you're doing a sequel to a picture that was a $1 billion blockbuster, you really have to spend that kind of budget on special effects. Special effects are a nightmare because the director never says that's good enough. He always says, give me one more try.
Hmm. What about the Academy Awards? We mentioned Hurt Locker. It won an Oscar, and I don't think it's to this minute has made back its cost.
No, but look at The King's Speech and look at Black Swan. I mean, those pictures have grossed more than $200 million, and both represent important anomalies because they were both reminders that if you make an art picture, you can still reach a huge international audience. People out there want to see good movies.
And I'm always surprised because small films will often take off and do quite well. And if you invest $10 million in a movie that makes $100 million, that's quite a bit of profit. That can mix in with the $300 million film that makes $1 billion. Mm-hmm. And yet the studios still seem to be reluctant to make the small ones along with the big ones.
They're not reluctant. They're absolutely antithetical to it. They don't want to make those pictures. And they feel that if you can make a picture, a sequel that has a built-in audience, that there's recognition, then you remove the gamble. The trouble with making the King's Speech is that it was something of a stage play, and the people who funded it, and it's a group of people, I mean, you had to pass the hat, they had no idea that this would resonate with an audience.
The subtitle of your book is A Tale of Movies, The Mob and Sex. Is the mob still in Hollywood?
Absolutely not. Corporate Hollywood is devoid of any interplay with the mob. But and
are
again,
you serious?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the boys have gone elsewhere for profit.
And that's because they were pushed out? Because Hollywood, corporate Hollywood, is really New York, and movies being made in the Brooklyn Navy Yard in Greenpoint.
I think it was just a different era. For one thing, the government, the feds, were becoming very interested in the activities of the mob. And again, Deep Throat sort of put the spotlight on their activities.
Peter Bart will be speaking with Janet Maslin tonight following a screening of Harold and Maude at 7 o'clock at the Jacob Burns Film Center in Pleasantville. For more information about that, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. His latest book, Infamous Players, A Tale of Movies, The Mob, and Sex, is published by Weinstein Books. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you.